This is one of a series of lectures using the studies of my God's Plan for Man book and my Bible chart. I am Finis Jennings Dake, and the subject of this lecture is the book of Revelation. We pointed out to you in the last lecture on events that were to come to pass from John's day into all eternity, all of it prophecy. And we covered the church age, all the things concerning the churches. Then John was told in the fourth chapter, verse 1, to come up to heaven, and I will show you things which must be after the churches. So from chapter 4, 1 through Revelation 19, 21, we have the last 7 years of this age covered in almost detail. In other words, all those details in that section, Revelation 4, 1 through Revelation 19, 21, will happen during the last 7 years of this age, during the reign of the Antichrist, during the time that the tribulation is running its course. So if you'll mark that section aside, chapter 4:1 on to the end of the 19th chapter, just place it where it belongs between the rapture and the second coming of Jesus Christ to the earth, the whole book will be a very simple book for you. In chapter 20, we have the millennial reign of Jesus Christ on the earth. And in chapters 21 and 22, the new heavens and the new earth. Now, there are several subjects in the book that we did not cover in all this previous study. One, the great whore of Revelation 17. This great whore is called the mother of harlots and the abominations of the earth. She's called a great whore. She's called a great city in 17:18 of Revelation. So when we think of the great whore of Revelation 17, we must think of it as a spiritual or a religious system. She is not a political power, for she is not classed as one with the kings of the earth or queens of the earth. She is not a political power in any degree. She is a religious power, a power that dominates the ten kingdoms and the ten kings themselves, while Antichrist is coming to full power over the kings of the old Roman Empire in those days. In verse 1, we read, she is a great whore that sitteth upon many waters. And in verse 15, those waters are explained to be multitudes, kindreds, and tongues, and nations. She sits on a scarlet-colored beast, not on seven heads in succession, but on the body of the beast itself. The heads on the beast symbolize seven world empires from the day of Moses in Egypt to the time of the second coming of Jesus Christ to the earth. That's what we read in 17:8. The beast which thou sawest was and is not and shall ascend out of the bottomless pit and go into perdition. And all that dwell upon the earth shall wonder whose names are not found written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world, when they behold the beast that was and is not and yet is or shall be. Here is wisdom. The seven heads on which the woman sitteth are seven kingdoms. Five are fallen. That is, Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, Media, Persia, and Greece are fallen. One is the old Roman Empire at the time John saw the revelation. And the other, the seventh, is not yet come. And when he cometh, he must continue a short space. But in verse 11, it is further explained that the beast itself is not any one of those seven kingdoms, but it is the eighth kingdom. The Grecian Empire revived again as the eighth kingdom, and that helps us to understand what is meant by the head wounded to death and his deadly wound was healed, and all the world wondered after the beast. The idea is that one of those five kingdoms that had fallen before John saw the revelation, that had already passed away, that one of those kingdoms will become revived again as the eighth world empire, the kingdom of the Antichrist itself. And the idea of the head wounded to death is not that the Antichrist will receive a personal wound and will be assassinated and be resurrected from the dead, or his bodily wound will be healed and the whole world will wonder after him. No idea at all. It is the idea of one of the first five kingdoms that had fallen before John's day becoming the eighth kingdom, the kingdom of the Antichrist. So it's a revival of an empire, not the personal wounding or assassination of the Antichrist, as some people teach. Now, the Bible teaches us here that these seven heads are seven kingdoms that precede the eighth kingdom. Now, many Bible interpreters, and it is strange how so many, many, many of them will make these seven heads refer to seven hills on which the city of Rome is built. If this be the case, you know what you would have to believe? You would have to believe that five of these hills had already flattened out before John saw the book of Revelation. And you would have to believe that Rome was only on one hill at the time John saw the Revelation. And you would have to further believe that the seventh of these hills was going to be piled up and Rome was going to have to be moved over on a seventh hill. And that isn't all. Strangest thing of it all is that the beast itself is an eighth hill or an eighth kingdom or an eighth head, you might say, referring to the kingdom of the Antichrist itself. So it is not the idea of Rome as a city of seven hills. In fact, this does not refer to Rome in the least, not the slightest reference in this whole 17th chapter of Revelation that refers to Rome or the Roman Catholic Church or to any part of the Roman Empire necessarily. So we have the idea of seven kingdoms. Five are fallen, one is, the other is not yet come, and the eighth kingdom is the kingdom of the Antichrist. Now, we've heard just recently that Moscow is a city of seven hills, and so Bible scholars keep piling up all kinds of fool theories, bringing Moscow, bringing Russia, bringing communism, bringing all kinds of things into the Revelation that the Revelation does not one time mention itself. But the thing about this great whore now sitting upon this seventh kingdom during the rise of the Antichrist to power to make this eighth kingdom, she is drunken with the blood of the saints of Jesus. And she is the one really murdering the saints of Jesus the last 3.5 years of this 7-year period. The Antichrist murders the saints of Jesus the last 3.5 years of this 7-year period, known as Daniel's 70th week or the tribulation. But she murders the saints now in the first 3.5 years. Then we read in verses 16 and 17, "At the 10 kings shall hate the whore, and shall burn her flesh, and make her desolate and naked, for God hath put it in their hearts to agree and give their kingdom to the beast till the words of God should be fulfilled." All right, now we have the idea of the saints being murdered by a different person altogether in the first 3.5 years than the Antichrist of the last 3.5 years. But the great tribulation is during the last 3.5 years, and the murder of the saints during that time and the tribulation that Antichrist will cause is going to be so much greater than the great whore and her persecution of the saints of Jesus that there is no comparison. Jesus spoke of it as a time of tribulation such as never was or never will be again. And Daniel 12:1 refer the same thing. Jeremiah 30 puts it this way, "And wherefore do I see every man with his hands on his loins as a woman in travail? Alas, it is the time of Jacob's trouble, yet he shall be saved out of it." So the murder of the saints of Jesus is carried on by the great whore and the 10 kings the first 3.5 years while Antichrist is coming to power over the 10 kings. We saw in our study of Daniel that the 10 horns exist on the head of the fourth beast, representing the revised Roman Empire of the latter days, the 10 kingdoms that Bible scholars are talking about. All right, now the 10 kings then will be that inside the Roman Empire territory. And Antichrist comes after those 10 kingdoms are formed, and from among them, and he conquers 3 in his rise to power. Daniel 7:8 tells us he shall subdue 3 kings. That is, he conquers Greece, Turkey, and Egypt by the help of Syria, and in the middle of the seven-year period, the 10 kings, the rest of them who are not conquered by him, will submit to the Antichrist without any further struggle. That gives Antichrist full power the last 3 1/2 years of this age, called 42 months in the 13th chapter of Revelation and verse 5. Power was given unto him, we read there, to continue 42 months. Now then the Antichrist turns on the Jews in that particular time, in the middle of the 7 years, and determines to exterminate the whole nation. But instead of that, we read of the countries north and east of the 10 kingdoms that they will make war on the Antichrist at this point, forcing him to leave the Jews alone for the time being until he goes north and east to conquer those many nations that are united together against him. So the Antichrist conquers the 10 kingdoms by the latter part of that period, and then he brings all the nations down against Jesus Christ and the Jews to destroy the Jews at the Battle of Armageddon, the thing which he wanted to do in the middle of the 7 years, but was hindered in doing because of these new wars that are declared against him. Now then the Antichrist turns on the saints of Jesus, Christians, Jews, anybody who will not worship him. We read that he will be worshipped in those days as God, sitting in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. 2 Thessalonians 2:3-4. We read of the worship of the Antichrist in the 12th chapter of the book of Revelation. We read of a false prophet arising and exercising the power of the first beast before him, and he demands the worship of the world to that first beast that had the wound of him. So the Antichrist will be the object of worship the last 3 1/2 years, and this is no doubt why the great whore of Revelation 17 is destroyed, so that the Antichrist can be the object of worship, so that he can murder the saints of Jesus and carry on without any hindrance at all from the great whore or from the 10 kings. Following all these events of the last first 3 1/2 years, we read that the great whore is destroyed by the 10 kings and the Antichrist, who give their power to the Antichrist and submit to his total will. Now there is another thing I want to call your attention to in the book of Revelation in connection with Revelation 16, 17, and 18, and that is literal Babylon. Mystical Babylon, or religious Babylon, is a religious city with headquarters in Babylon, according to the 18th verse of the 17th chapter, and she is called Mystery Babylon the Great, not literal Babylon. But now we come to literal Babylon itself. Literal Babylon is identified as a literal city, but not Rome. Babylon is altogether a different city from Rome, and I figured years ago that if God knew what Rome was and knew what Babylon was, and he would call Rome Babylon, that was a mighty peculiar thing to do. But there is no excuse for this. It literally means a literal city that used to be located on the river Euphrates. Rome, the city of Rome, or the Roman Church, is not one time referred to in any prophecy of the entire Bible. But when it comes to Babylon, a literal city, then it's a different thing altogether. The Bible does teach that Babylon will be rebuilt again, that it was destroyed throughout the centuries, little by little, until it has become more or less a deserted place. But in the future, it will become the great commercial center of the world in the days when Antichrist arises. Babylon is located on the river Euphrates. And the Bible teaches us that Babylon will be overthrown as God overthrew Gomorrah. And the prophecy of this type has never been literally fulfilled yet. But in the 18th chapter of Revelation, we read that Babylon will be destroyed in 1 hour. Babylon will never be inhabited again is another teaching of the prophets. Isaiah 13:20, Jeremiah 50:39-40, And Jeremiah 51, 29 to 43, you have the idea that Babylon, in its final overthrow, will never be inhabited from that time on into all eternity. Then we have another thing about Babylon, that it must be in existence in the day of the Lord, which means at the second coming of Christ. For Isaiah 13, 6 and 13, and Revelation 16, 17 to 21, Revelation 14, 8, Revelation 18, 1 to 24, and 19, 1 through 3, all refer to Babylon in the last days, Babylon being fulfilled when the book of Revelation is completely fulfilled in those chapters. So since we're not in the day of the Lord, and the day of the Lord does not take place until the second coming of Jesus Christ to the earth, then we must recognize that there will be a definite and a literal city called Babylon in that future day. Babylon must be destroyed under the seventh vial, because we read in the 16th chapter of Revelation, verses 17 to 21, that when the seventh angel pours out his bowl upon the earth, that the great city Babylon is destroyed by an earthquake. Jerusalem is divided into three places, three parts, and the cities of the nations fall. So we have to believe these things literally. The 18th chapter of Revelation, the whole 24 verses, describe the destruction of a literal city in the day of the Lord under the seventh vial, when that earthquake completely destroys Babylon and Jerusalem and various other cities of the nation. Babylon is to be overthrown in the future day of the Lord, therefore must exist in that day in order to be overthrown. Babylon is to be destroyed when Christ comes from heaven with his heavenly armies. Isaiah 13, 1 to 5, and 14, 5, and 25, 27, as well as the passages in Revelation, all speak of the destruction of this city at the second advent of Christ. The site of Babylon is on the river Euphrates, near the city called Hillah at the present time. So, but it will be a great city in the day when these scriptures will be literally fulfilled. Babylon is to be destroyed in the day of Israel's final restoration and blessing. And all that proves a further destruction of literal Babylon. Israel is to rule over her oppressors in the day of the Lord, or when Christ comes. And we read in the first verses of the 14th chapter of Isaiah that Babylon is the greatest oppressor of Israel that ever has been or ever will be. Then we read of Babylon being destroyed suddenly from heaven by a great judgment from God itself, even in 1 hour. Babylon is considered as a commercial center of the world, because the 5th chapter of the book of Zechariah, verses 5 to 11, picture the rebuilding of Babylon again. The prophet saw two women having wings of a stork, lifting up a bushel basket between the earth and the heavens. And when they were taking this up through the heavens, the lid came up and a woman stuck out her head. And the prophet asked, "Whither do these bear the ephah?" And he said, or the answer was, "To build it an house in the land of Shinar, and it shall be established upon its base." So Babylon must become a political center, a religious center, and a great commercial center of the world in those days we are talking about. Babylon must be burned by fire, according to Revelation 18, 1 to 18, and 19, 3. Babylon must be destroyed by an earthquake, according to the 16th chapter of Revelation 17 to 21. And Babylon must never be found after her final destruction. Babylon must sink into the earth. And then, of course, Babylon will be one of the hell holes that men will look into, looking into hell itself, as stated in various scriptures. There is a scripture in the 66th chapter of Isaiah, verses 22 to 24, which reads, "Concerning the new heavens and the new earth which I shall make, saith the Lord, they shall remain before me, so shall your seed and your name remain. It shall come to pass that from one new moon to another, and one Sabbath to another, shall all flesh come and worship before me, saith the Lord. and they, all flesh, shall go and look upon the carcasses of the men that have transgressed against me, for their fire shall not be quenched, their worm shall not die, and they shall be an abhorring unto all flesh. There will be certain openings, in other words, in the new earth, where men can go and look into hell and see those who are in eternal torment in hell. Not only do we have that idea in the 66th chapter of Isaiah, but in Revelation 14:9-14, we read, "If any man worship the beast in his image and receive his mark of the right hand or on the forehead, the same shall drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is poured out without mixture in the cup of his indignation. And he shall be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the Lamb, in the presence of the holy angels. The smoke of their torment ascendeth up forever and ever. And they have no rest, who worships the beast in his image, and whoever receives the mark in the right hand or in the forehead." So we notice here, in the presence of the Lamb, and in the presence of the holy angels. Also in Revelation 21:8 and 22:15, we have the idea that outside the holy city Jerusalem, which will come from God out of heaven at the end of the millennium, to be located right on the earth itself, we read that without, outside the city, outside the walls of this new city, earthly Jerusalem and heavenly Jerusalem, also it said, without are dogs and sorcerers and whoremongers, and whosoever loveth and maketh a lie. There is another subject I want to call your attention to in a few minutes, and that is about the false prophet out of the earth. The Bible teaches in Revelation 13, verse 11, that after the Antichrist arises and is given power over all kindreds and tongues and nations, that there will be another man arise out of the earth or from among men. That's in the 11th verse of the 13th chapter of Revelation. He is coming on the scene to exercise the power of the Antichrist himself. Now the Antichrist is going to get his power from the devil. In 2 Thessalonians 2, 8-12, we read about whose coming is after the working of Satan with all power, signs, and lying wonders, and with all deceivableness of unrighteousness in them that perish, because they receive not the love of the truth, that they might be saved. For this cause God shall send them strong delusion, that they might believe a lie and be damned who believe not the truth, but had pleasure in unrighteousness. So here we have this man coming to exercise the power of the devil that is given to the Antichrist. The devil will endue the Antichrist with power, give him power. For we read that the dragon gave him his power, throne, and great authority in the first verses of the 13th chapter of Revelation. Then we read of this man rising. He's going to call the attention of the whole world to this Antichrist, and he's going to make an image to the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause as many as would not worship the beast to be killed. All right, now we are to examine two men working together in the days of the Antichrist. First beast of Revelation 13:1-10 is the personal Antichrist himself. The second beast is a man pictured in the 11th verse to the 18th verse of that same 13th chapter of Revelation. He will exercise the power of the first beast and will even cause fire to come down from heaven and do all kinds of miracles in the sight of the first beast, calling attention to the world that this man is God. And Paul tells us himself in 2 Thessalonians 2:4 that the Antichrist will exalt himself above all that is called God, so that he as God sitteth in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. And so this second beast will also do great wonders and call the attention of the world to this first beast who had the wound by the sword and did live. Now whoever this beast is, we do not know. Even who the Antichrist will be, we do not know. And no man will ever know until after the rapture of the church. For 2 Thessalonians 2:7 and 8 tells us plainly, "Only he who now hindereth will hinder until he be taken out of the way. And then, after that, shall that wicked be revealed, whom the Lord shall consume with the spirit of his mouth, shall destroy with the brightness of his coming." We don't know who this first man is. We will not know until after the rapture of the church, until he comes on the scene himself. But we can and we cannot know who this second man is until he comes on the scene. All we are supposed to do is to take the revelation just as simply and clearly as it reads and quit worrying our heads about things that are not plainly revealed. Now then, as to another point in Revelation I want to call your attention to, that's found in the 7th chapter of the book of Revelation in connection with the 144,000. We read there that he saw an angel ascending from the east, having the seal of the living God. He cried to the first four trumpet judgment angels, saying, "Hurt not the earth, or the grass, or the trees of the seas, till we have sealed the servants of our God in their forehead." Seal the servants of our God in their forehead. Now this is interpreted by literally hundreds of thousands of people today as referring to keeping Saturday as the Sabbath. I don't want to throw any reflection on anybody, but facts are facts. The world knows that there are people who believe that the seal of the living God in Revelation 7 is keeping Saturday as the Sabbath. But if you will turn to the 14th chapter of the book of Revelation in verse 1, you will find here definitely stated, "I saw a lamb on Mount Zion with him 144,000, having his father's name written in their foreheads." Having the father's name written in their foreheads. Now, if that doesn't explain what this seal of the living God is, there isn't anything that explains it. But it certainly is not keeping Saturday as the Sabbath. In fact, when it comes to the Sabbath question, did you know that the whole world is more or less deceived as to the Sabbath question? Without any cause whatsoever, without any reasonable excuse for such rank and complete ignorance about the Sabbath day. The Bible literally teaches that the Ten Commandments, including the Sabbath commandment, was abolished, and the new contract, the New Testament, has now taken the place of the old contract that was abolished. Let me give you some simple scriptures to prove that to be the case. If you would read this one scripture alone, that would be sufficient to give you that understanding. 2 Corinthians 3:6-15, "Who has also made us able ministers of the New Testament, if the ministration of death written and engraven in stones," and what part of the Bible was that? What part of the Bible was written and engraven in stones? I think all school children can tell you that, if the grown-ups cannot. Everybody would have to acknowledge that the Ten Commandments in particular was what was written on the two tables of stone. All right, now he said, "For if the ministration of death written and engraven in stones, the Ten Commandments, was glorious, so that the children of Israel could not steadfastly behold the face of Moses for the glory of his countenance, which was to be done away, for if the ministration of condemnation be glory, much more doth the ministration of righteousness exceed in glory. For even that," he said, "which was made glorious," the Old Testament, the Ten Commandment law, "had no glory in this respect by reason of the glory that excelleth. For if that which was done away," that which was done away. Now here two times already in this one passage, the phrase "done away" is used of the Ten Commandments written and engraven on stone. "For if the old covenant written and engraven in stones was glorious, which was done away, much more that the new covenant which remaineth is glorious. Not as Moses, which put a veil over his face, that the children of Israel could not steadfastly look to the end of that which is abolished," which is abolished. So thus in verse 11, verse 13, and verse 7, and verse 14 of this third chapter of 2 Corinthians, three times the phrase "is done away" is used, and one time "abolished." Then it continues in the 14th verse, but their minds were blinded, "for until this day remaineth the same veil untaken away in the reading of the Old Testament, which is done away in Christ." Four times in one chapter we read simple things like that, and yet we go on 1,900 years without even paying attention to what we read, not even believing it, and resenting it when somebody calls your attention to it, perhaps, that the Ten Commandments and the old contract have been completely abolished. And we have a new contract called the New Testament, mentioned in the same third chapter of 2 Corinthians. So The law, we read, was given by Moses, but grace and truth came by Jesus Christ. Law-keeping was never required of the Old or the New Testament Christians in the early days. The apostles and elders came to consider the question of Sabbath and the law of Moses, and they decided that the law was not in force because Jesus Christ had abolished in his own flesh the commandments as expressed in the second chapter of the book of Ephesians, verses 14 to 15. Then also we have a statement in Colossians 3, 14 to 17, blotting out the handwriting of ordinances that were contrary to us and nailing it to the cross, having spoiled principalities and powers, made a show of them openly, triumphing over them in the cross. Let no man therefore judge you in meats or in drinks or in respect of new moons or of Sabbath days, which are a shadow of things to come. He is our peace who hath broken down the middle wall of partition between us, having abolished in his flesh the enmity, even the law of commandments contained in ordinances, for to make of himself of twain one new man, so making peace. Thus you see that just one scripture after another definitely telling us that the old covenant has been abolished. In fact, in the book of Galatians 3:19-25, we read the law was added because of transgression till the seed, Christ, should come, to whom the promise was made. But before faith came, before Christ came, we are shut up under the law, shut up under the faith which should afterward be revealed. Wherefore, the law was our schoolmaster to bring us to Christ, that we might be justified by faith. But after that faith has come, we are no longer under a schoolmaster. No longer under a schoolmaster. So the law, including the Ten Commandments, have been cast out. That's what we read in the fourth chapter of the book of Galatians, where he deals with the two contracts, one made at Sinai and one made by Jesus Christ. And he said, "Wherefore, saith the law, cast out the bondwoman and her son. You that desire to be under the law," Paul argues in that same chapter, "why, you're under obligation to keep the whole law." Then we read of other statements in the book of Hebrews alone, four or five statements in that chapter alone, where it says the law being changed, there is made of necessity a change in the law also. For there is verily a disannulling of the commandment going before for the weakness and unprofitableness thereof. For the law made nothing perfect, but the bringing in of a better hope did, by which Christ is assured last year, and January the 2nd you would hail me to court for breaking your contract, and the judge would see that that contract expired on January the 1st, he would chase us both out of court. And if we wanted a new contract this year, we would have to make one. And what part of last year's contract we wanted to bring into the new contract, only that part of the old contract would still be in force under the new contract. And that part we didn't want in the new contract, we would just leave it out altogether. So it is with the Old and New Testaments, the Old and New Covenants. We must recognize that if we want to find out whether we are to obey the Ten Commandments or not, or to obey any part of the old contract or not, well, let's go to the new contract and see for ourselves what it says. And taking the Ten Commandments and doing this with the new contract, we do come up with some startling facts. That the fourth commandment is not one time referred to in the entire new covenant. And the new covenant was made and ratified by the blood of Jesus Christ. But it is not in force at the present time. But you go through the new contract, you will know if can I commit adultery if the old contract has been canceled? If adultery, the law on adultery has been canceled? No. You have to go to your new contract and see if it also forbids you to commit adultery. And dishonoring your parents or any one of the Ten Commandments, you must not worry about what the old covenant said because it is abolished. You must go to the new covenant and find out if the same laws, if the same commandments are found in the new covenant that were part of the Ten Commandments of the old covenant. In doing that, we find nine of the Ten Commandments in the new contract. We do not find the fourth commandment at all. The fourth commandment has been left out. And why? Because God told the children of Israel through Hosea chapter 2, verse 11, I will do away with all of her mirth, all of her feast days, and all of her new moons, and all of her Sabbath days. I'm going to do away with all the Sabbaths of Israel. There God was under obligation from that minute on to sometime in the future to do away with the old law Sabbath. The Sabbath question altogether, just completely do away with it and remove it. So God, if he was ever going to be faithful and true to his word, he was under obligation from that minute on to leave out this old Sabbath question, leave it out altogether in making the new contract. And Isaiah referred to the same thing. Isaiah 1:13, your Sabbath days, your new moon, your feasts, away with it. Did you know why God commanded the children of Israel to worship on the Sabbath day? If you'll turn to Deuteronomy 5:15, remember, thou wert a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord thy God brought thee out with a mighty hand. Therefore the Lord thy God commanded thee to keep the Sabbath days, commanded thee to keep the Sabbath days. So since they had no rest day at all, any Sabbath at all in their slavery under Pharaoh, God said, I'm going to set aside one day a week for you, and I want you to remember that I did it because I respected your slavery under Pharaoh. But to the church and to the Gentiles who are never under the law of Moses, for we read in Romans 2:12-16, that the Gentiles which have not the law, see, the Jews only had the law. Gentiles have not the law, do by nature the things contained in the law, these having not the law are a law unto themselves. But at any rate, to make a long story short, the Ten Commandments were left out of the old contract as far as the old contract part is concerned. In other words, it was abolished along with the old contract. And now what we must do is to obey those commandments that are part of the new contract and used to be a part of the old contract. And we say again that the fourth commandment is the only one of the Ten Commandments that really was left out of the new contract altogether. But you'll find nine of the Ten Commandments in the new contract, and you are still under obligation to obey those commandments, just like if you were still under the old contract. Now then, as to the new covenant, what it says about the Sabbath, we have several simple scriptures. We already gave you one in Colossians 2:12-17. Let no man judge you in meats, drinks, respect of holy day, new moon, or Sabbath days. Don't let any man judge you about these things. Then in Romans 14, verses 5 and 6, one man esteemeth one day above another man esteemeth every day alike. Let every man be fully persuaded in his own mind. If you want to regard the day, he said, to the Lord, regard it. If you don't want to regard the day to the Lord, you don't have to regard it, because there isn't any special commandment for to remember any particular day as the Sabbath today, or under the new contract terms. So he said, let every man be fully persuaded in his own mind. The early Christians, according to John 20, where we have it stated twice, and Acts 20, and 1 Corinthians 16, 1 and 2, the early Christians observed the first day of the week, not as a matter of commandment, not because they were commanded to do so, but because the Jews were in the habit of keeping Saturday as the Sabbath, or keeping the Sabbath. And so, when we read the New Covenant scriptures, we don't find any definite commandment that you've got to continue keeping the seventh day every time as a Sabbath, and you're free to do anything you want to along this particular line. Then we are absolutely freed from all responsibility as to keeping Sabbath days. So they kept the first day of the week as a matter of record, because that was the day on which Jesus Christ was resurrected from the dead. I could give you many more scriptures along this line, but these facts are simple and clear, and it only shows us that the Sabbath, as dealt with by some people and who are trying to force a particular Sabbath upon people in general, that there are no grounds for such enforcement of any particular Sabbath under the new contract. Now, the thing for us to do is just recognize this. Keep one day as you want to. Obey God, obey Christ, and the main thing about Christianity is that of living a godly, consecrated life. So, the seal of the living God in Revelation 7 and Revelation 14:1, it is not keeping Saturday as the Sabbath. That much is clear. Now then, in the 19th chapter of Revelation, the first 10 verses, we have the marriage supper of the Lamb mentioned. That means that the church is raptured by this time, and the church is in heaven at this time before the second advent begins. For in the 10 verses of this chapter, we have the marriage supper, and then, only after then, do we read of the heaven open and the armies of heaven following Christ out of heaven on white horses clothed in linen, white and clean. Then comes the second coming of Christ. All the redeemed saints, the raptured saints, who will be caught up to heaven, even some of them at least 7 years before the marriage supper. They will come back with Christ after the tribulation and help him fight at the battle of Armageddon, set up a kingdom in the world even forever and ever.